I don't know if hornet stings and bee stings are the same on the allergy scale, but either way, the Lakers got stung bad last night by the Hornets. We'll talk about that game. We'll talk a little bit about the Lakers bench concerns over that. Of course, we'll get into the trade market with your questions, your comments coming in live here on the Lakers Collective YouTube channel. Is there pressure on Rob Pelinka to get a move done? I'm Trevor Lane, Jovan Buha, Jason Tipp. We got a lot of stuff to get into. Jovan, the Lakers right now or moving, what's worse?
The Lakers on it, honestly. Moving, at least I have something to look forward to. Yeah. I'm not quite sure. I'm not quite sure where this season's going.
Oh my goodness! This is this was not a. You know what? From Jason, from a just a basketball enjoyment experience, like that was actually a pretty high octane offensive game that we saw last night, especially from the Hornets, but being on the receiving end of that, not so much fun.
Yeah, there was this weird stretch in the middle of the third quarter where I'm like, the Hornets are just spamming ISO threes at the top of the key and it's working. Like it's just like they're just picking on either Luka or DeAndre Ayton and taking step backs, including that absolutely comical LaMelo Ball step back where he got south of the foul line and then somehow got all the way back above the break line. But at the end of the day, like, you know, in a weird way, and I'm curious to see after we talk this out today, if you guys agree or if we're in a different spot, but like after both of these games, the Kings game and the Hornets game, I've been less discouraged, considerably less discouraged than I was after other losses that the Lakers have had elsewhere in the season. There are certain things to me that kind of are what they are about this team. Like, we know that they've got really inconsistent jump shooting. And when you've got a situation where Austin Reeves is out and Rui Hachimura is coming back from an injury and is very out of rhythm, that obviously the jump shooting talent is going to scream off the screen as a problem for this team. And there are certain things where you're watching like Gabe Vincent just give up straight line drive after straight line drive to Miles Bridges and to Con Knipple. And you're like, dude, come on. This is like the one thing you're out here for. At least beat these dudes to the spot. You know, there are certain things that are certainly frustrating. I don't want to make it act like it's all positive, but there's also a lot of times where I'm looking at the screen and I'm like, there are four dudes on the floor right now who won't be in the playoff rotation. You know, you're looking out there and it's like, there's a G League guard on the floor with a centerless lineup with LeBron to, you know, whether it's, you know, I don't think we're going to see a whole lot of Jared Vanderbilt or Gabe Vincent in the rotation when we get into early April. So like, there's a lot of that kind of stuff that I'm willing to kind of set aside. And I also want to tip the cap to the Kings and the Hornets. I genuinely think both of those teams are playing really good basketball right now. Like, there is a level of depth of shot creation and offensive talent that Charlotte's flashing right now. Sacramento, all their shot creators are playing super well and they're shooting the three ball well, and they have a considerable amount of athletic depth that can cause some problems. Like, Sacramento's chewing up and spitting out a lot of good teams right now, and Charlotte's been playing good basketball for a couple of weeks. And so I look at this a lot more like this Lakers team has their issues, but they're running into some pretty good teams right now, and I'm not overly surprised that they're struggling a little bit. And then the second piece of it is, there are some clear things that I think stretch forward. Like, LeBron and Luka look awesome. Mm-hmm. Luka, again, he's at 41% from three on 9 attempts per game over his last 7 games. He's starting to figure that out. Only 1 turnover last night. LeBron's gaining real momentum. So as bad as it looks, I do think that there are some things that you could take away from this, that when Austin gets back, when Rui gets back in a rhythm, if this team hits on a trade or two, I actually think there's some like kind of light at the end of the tunnel in terms of where this team could put all this together and play some better basketball down the line, despite some disappointing results right now.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that the Hornets and the Kings have been playing well. I talked about that last night on my show, that this wasn't a game where the Lakers just no-showed and the Hornets just kind of stumbled into the end zone or something like that and were handed a win. The Hornets legitimately played well last night, and their offense was fantastic. They exploited the Lakers where they needed to. And I talked about it going into this game, that if you look at the Hornets and you just go, oh, it's the Hornets, they're awful, this should be an easy win, you're in for a rude awakening. This team is very good. They are very explosive offensively, and specifically the way that they're explosive offensively is the way the Lakers are weak defensively, and that's behind the three-point line being such a problem, their ability to contain those drives from the perimeter, creating drives and kicks. And the Hornets did exploit those things, had a bit of a above-average shooting game, and they ultimately got the win. Jovan, how do you balance this? Because I see some people make the point, included, I think it was made by JJ Redick after the game, that the Hornets shot above average from three here. How much of that?
I'm so sick of that. I'm so sick of that.
I was getting this, and this is why I want to ask you, because you're Mr. Two Things can both be true. It's true they shot above average. It was not as absurd as the Kings 65%, where they're probably not shooting that in an open gym, but this was, they were above 40%. How much of it is the Hornets shot above average versus how much of it is the Lakers are bad defending the three?
I think two things can be true. And JJ said that after almost every loss. And at some point you have to think about, okay, sure, you have your analytics crew going through the numbers, and these are the shooters we feel okay helping off of. These are the guys we want to leave open. These are the guys we want to maybe soft contest. These are the guys we want to hard contest. But I think the Lakers are bad at running players off the three-point line. I think they're bad at screen navigation. They're bad at their off-ball switching. And they're bad at making teams feel uncomfortable when they're pressuring them at the three-point line. I also think it gets them into some bad habits. And there's a mentality component to this where it's like, okay, if we're going to help off a couple of shooters, or maybe not be as aggressive with how we're defending the three-point line, I think that bleeds into larger stretches of the game. It also bleeds into some of the defense against the good shooters in some of those stretches. So I do agree with the premise that, sure, there are guys that have shot better against the Lakers over the last like few years. It's felt like they're getting like the best shooting performance from a team of, we continually hear like, this player hit their season high in threes against the Lakers. This team hit their season high in three against the Lakers. Like, this has been a thing for a bit. At the same time, I think from a process perspective, they are way too passive with their three-point defense. And again, I don't think this team is talented enough defensively to be able to pick and choose how they're defending the three-point line. And I think, again, it can lend itself to some bad habits with them where it's like, okay, we're helping off a couple of these guys, but all of a sudden, you know, a shooter comes off the bench and then they start defending that guy the same way they were defending the non-shooter. And to be completely honest, like, in the moment, I was like, Charlotte is hitting some ridiculous shots right now. And certainly the LaMelo one that Jason was talking about, Con Knipple hit a three with Jake LaRavia, was right there, hand up, contested. That was a tough three. They had a couple in the left corner in front of their bench, certainly hit some ridiculous shots. But going back, and specifically in that early third quarter, which is when I thought the three-point shooting was the most ridiculous, most of those shots were open. And like the Lakers, it was a lot of, we're going under a pick and roll for some reason, leaving LaMelo wide open for three. We're not rotating out to shooters. Miles Bridges got one open in the corner. There was a couple driving kicks to the right wing that were wide open. And I'm like, it was a lot of like the fake contest where the guy gets the shot up, then you contest after the shot's already up. So it kind of like looks contested, but it's not really. So I thought it was a lot of just bad three-point defense. And this has been a thing. And JJ keeps trumpeting shot quality, expected field goal percentage. That only gets you so far, because right now they are one of the five worst three-point defenses in the NBA. They've been that pretty consistently most of the season. And you can keep talking about the expected field goal percentage, but I'm watching them get torched at the three-point line. And I don't like, there might be nights where teams just don't make them, which is fine, but they're turning teams into good three-point shooting teams. I think that's a big issue.
I'm so glad you pointed this out, Jovan. I think focusing on shooting variance is one of the most loser things that I see around the NBA. And I've seen teams do it. I've seen fans do it. I've seen people in the media do it. And like, I'm not going to sit here and pretend like shooting variance isn't part of the equation. It certainly is. It's essentially proven statistically that it's part of the equation. I just think it's pretty far down the list compared to other controllable factors. And like, yeah, like there's a simple like albatross stat, like from last night, the Hornets hit seven off the dribble threes. That is the most they've hit in a single game this entire season. They average 3.5. They on the season shoot 32% on them, which is a pretty bad percentage. They made a bunch of them last night. But like, you can watch the game and see that their ball handlers are so comfortable versus us compared to the way they look against other teams around the league. And if like anybody who's ever played basketball knows that that matters, when you're dribbling up the floor and you feel like you can get into your bag and you're not going to be disrupted, you can go to moves that you practice 100 times a day in your shooting workouts, and it feels supernatural and fluid and easy. Whereas when Lou Dort's up in your shit for 60 feet and he's disrupting your handle and you're trying to get into that shot, it's completely different. And the other, like, even the actual tracking metrics for shot quality to me are heavily flawed because of what Jovan just said. There's a huge difference between a hand being there at the top of the shot when you're dealing with professional basketball players that literally have been shooting contested shots their entire life, and they don't even see that hand as long as they can get into their muscle memory, versus when a player is actually there disrupting something in the rhythm of the shot, whether it's disrupting their feet, disrupting their gather, getting that contest early enough to where their release like tweaks a little higher or something gets funky on their follow through. There is a fundamental difference between a contest and a contest that actually bothers a shooter. And that is not tracked by a camera over the top that can't differentiate between a player that's there and a player that was actually doing something to disrupt the shot early in the routine. And so even the tracking data for shot quality, I think, is heavily flawed. And so I just think focusing on that as a team is loser behavior. You have to do something to get a player to miss. You have to do something in the controllables to force that, rather than just being like, oh, well, we followed our game plan and the Hornets can't make pull-up threes, and they made them tonight. I was watching them. LaMelo was like, he was making Instagram reels last night. That's easy work for him.
Yeah, this is, you know, one of the worst things about the first year with Russell Westbrook was that the 22 season was, it felt like,
why'd you have to bring that up?
I'm sorry. I know we've been super negative, and I know we have collectively all repressed that year. It did not happen. One of the things that I do remember from that season was how much fun opponents had playing offense against the Lakers. You could see it every single night. Teams went, yes, we're gonna run our stuff and everything's gonna work. And they had a good time. I thought the Hornets had a very good time last night running their offense. They knew they were going to get the looks that they wanted. They knocked him down. LaMelo's taking one-legged shots in the corner and knocking him down. And some of that is, hey, you're hitting some tough shots and you tip your cap. But a lot of that too is Lakers defense. You know, Marcus Smart made the comment that we got to figure it out. It's not easy. Shooting goes through the roof against us. When you play for the Lakers, you're always the hunted. He said, well, if it's every team gets up to play the Lakers type of situation, the Lakers are being hunted. In this case, if the Lakers are the deer that's being hunted, it's the deer that's wearing the bright orange vest this time and not the hunter. They're making it easy to hunt them by not really contesting much on the perimeter, not doing a good enough job preventing teams from raining down threes on them. And a lot of it, I thought there was a clear athleticism deficit. But I'll tell you guys, the part that really bothered me last night was not just the defense, not just going under, why are you going under screens in the third quarter against a red hot Hornets team? It's not one, not two, multiple Lakers players that we saw in a game where you knew if you switch off defensively at all, it's going to be an open three. And I mean, mentally flip the switch off. We saw LeBron stop and stare at Miles Bridges while he shot a wide open three, and he tends to have big games against the Lakers. We saw DeAndre Ayton hang his head, slowly jog back. Hell, I saw Luka stop at half court, running back on defense, stop at half court to walk, and the result be an open corner three that the Hornets buried. I thought the Lakers, it wasn't just scheme-wise going under on things. There were also moments where the Lakers didn't play hard enough. I don't think it was a non-effort game, but the moments where they did switch off, boy, the Hornets, they punished them for it. In fact, we saw the Hornets, every time the Lakers stopped to complain to a referee, they went flying down the court. They went, oh, there's our opportunity. They screwed up. And the Lakers just played right into that. That was what frustrated me perhaps the most, was seeing how many times it was effort that contributed to the Hornets getting an open look.
What's so funny about that too, the 2020 Lakers, top 10 in opponent three-point percentage and top 10 in opponent three-point makes per game. Why wasn't everybody getting up for the Lakers back then? Or was it because they were a better, more physical defense that was making teams uncomfortable? Like, it's just, it's such a loser way to look at it.
Well, that, speaking of that, of being more physical, Marcus Smart said he feels like the foul calls have changed over the last month or so, that that referees are letting more go. And I would have to dig into the foul numbers, but anecdotally, I agree. I think that we have seen guys getting away with a lot more. Is that bothering them? And aside from, hey, man up, what does the response need to be?
I think it is bothering them. And this is something I've talked about. I believe we've talked about it going back earlier in the season, and I've talked about it on my show. Like, this was part of my fear with some of the early season grifting from Luka and Austin, was that I was thinking more in the playoffs, not necessarily in the regular season, but come playoff time, you are not going to get the same volume of calls. You're not going to get the same, I think, especially with both guys, it can be the, we get the guy on our hip or on our side and we just lunge into him and draw the foul that way. You're not getting that call consistently in the playoffs. And we've seen when the Lakers have not gotten that call in some of the, it's often been in the losses, and they don't get the free throw advantage. They start to get frustrated. They start to force it. They don't get back in transition. They're arguing with the refs. Like, this has been part of the formula for some of their losses, has been a team's able to physically defend them. They don't have a great counter, and then they sort of just unravel. So to your point, like, sure, man up and just kind of play through it. I think they need to have some more counters to that and understand that. I think you could often tell within the first like 5 to 7 minutes of a game how a game is being called and whether you're going to get that type of call. And if you're not getting that type of call, then you got to stop trying to do the same thing to get to the free throw line. And I think and it's not just like Luka and Austin are the two primary guys that do this, but even Marcus Smart last night was grifting a bit. Oh, yeah. He did the Chris Paul, I'm going to, you know, get in front of you on the pick and roll and just stop and have you jump into my back and fling it up. And like, he got that call. So like, it has infiltrated, you know, parts of the rotation that it's not just, you know, two of the three stars. LeBron's been getting to the free throw line a little bit more, and with him, I think it's more stuff at the rim that he's getting those calls. But I think that they got to be careful with that, because that is always the fear with a team that I believe they get the second highest percentage of their points at the free throw line of any team in the league behind Orlando. And the fear with that is like, you are somewhat reliant on the refs and how they're calling that game. And if you like, when you're getting the 25, 30, 35 free throws, it's great. When you're getting 15, 18, 20 free throws, now all of a sudden that margin that you're used to winning is all of a sudden gone. And we've seen that in some of the recent losses where they actually give up more free throws than they're attempting. And that's a losing formula for LA. So I think they got to figure that out, because long term, of course, just with the style of play, and Luka and Austin in particular are really good at drawing fouls, really good at getting to the free throw line. That is like, it's stable to a degree, but there is a big difference between like 12 free throws from those guys versus like 6 or 7. And I didn't mean to do that. If they're in that range, like, again, that really shifts the offensive efficiency, and it can get them in a tough predicament.
I do think it's worth mentioning that the Lakers are number one in free throw attempts over the last 15 games. So I think within that locker room, focusing on the officiating is silly. I will say it's worth mentioning, Marcus did say they need to get back. Marcus did say like, yeah, the calls are the calls, but we got to be running back instead of talking to the refs. And there's no doubt about that. Trevor, you called it out perfectly. I think the Lakers' effort has been pretty solid since Christmas Day, but there were just some glaring, like, let go of the rope moments. Like, LeBron had a brutal one at the end of the first shift that he had where, like, you could tell he played so great that first, like, 4.5-5 minutes. And then the final 2 minutes of his shift, he was quite literally standing around doing nothing because he was gassed. And it's like, at that point, just sub yourself out of the game if you're not going to play. You know what I mean? Like, there's a certain amount of, like, if you let go of the rope, even for 90 seconds against a good offense like that, they can go on a 7-0 run and kind of change the dynamic of the game.
And that was exactly my concern going into the game, in the game preview that we were talking about it, that this is a team where if they go through that stretch where their offense hits a drought, which they tend to do, and their defense switches off for any moments, that you can blink, 90 seconds go by and you've given up 12 points or whatever, because the Hornets just come down and go boom, 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 a bunch of threes in a row. A lot of people talking about the Lakers bench today. A lot of frustration with Gabe Vincent. He got booed in the building. Rob Pelinka was there in the building. Gabe Vincent got booed. Of course, I'm sure we'll talk about the trade front once we get into some of our chat questions and things like that. But they scored 27-9 in bench points. That wasn't the only problem. I thought the bench, you know, we could talk about Gabe. We already mentioned the straight line drives where he got blown by. But the bench, not good enough for LA.
We got to talk about the booze. We got to talk about the booze.
You want to talk about the? Okay, let's just get right into the booze then. So Gabe Vincent booed at home in LA. What did you think about that? And is that, I thought it was an appropriate response given the level that he played at, but I thought it was more than just frustration with Gabe Vincent. I thought that was pent up frustration overall that was being unleashed in that moment.
I think this has been building for 3 years. I think that that's the reality of the situation in with Gabe Vincent specifically. Like objectively, Gabe Vincent has been a bad signing, and he has not lived up to the contract that the Lakers signed him to. Now, a large part of that has been out of his control due to injuries. He's had multiple injuries that have kept him out for long stretches, and that's obviously not something that he can control. But when he has been available, he has not been the player that the Lakers signed or thought they were signing from that 2023 playoff run, you know, finals run with the Heat. Now, I would argue that the way that he played with Miami has not been the way that he's been used with LA. And there's a macro discussion we could have about LA continuing. We've talked about, like, what is a Lakers player, right? And what does the front office believe in? And they love these combo scoring guards. But then because of the personnel they've had, those guys aren't necessarily empowered to play that style of basketball. So you had a guy in Gabe Vincent who was on the ball a lot and is clearly a rhythm player as a scorer and a shooter. But now you're asking him to basically stand in the corner and just be a spot up guy. When if you look at his career numbers up until the Lakers signed him, he was not a reliable spot up shooter. He was not a reliable shooter in general. And defensively, there's clear limitations with him being 6'2". So I think the Lakers thought they could get a better version of Dennis, but they did not. And so I think this has been frustration with Gabe since the 2023-24 season. It has only been mounting over the last 3 years. And I think it finally came out in last night's performance, going 0-7, 0-5 on threes. And what was wild was, like, at first I thought it was just booing the team, kind of, because it happened after like the third or fourth miss from him. Then it started when he checked in, he got booed. Like the fan base was really upset with him last night. Then he misses, it's a swing, misses an open three at the top of the arc. And then the boos are really raining down. And it was very clearly pointed toward him, not just the team. I do agree with you, Trevor. There was collective frustration last night, but this has been like just a bad signing that has not worked out. He has not lived up to expectations when healthy. He has rarely been healthy over the last 3 years. And I think, I don't think the Lakers should just trade him just to trade him necessarily, but I don't think there's going to be a lot of love lost from the fan base if he ends up getting moved. And based on him being an expiring contract, LA probably should trade him, you know, turn the page on this chapter and just admit that this was a bad signing that has not worked out.
Yeah, look, I agree. I think they need to look to move him at the trade deadline. If they can, you're not moving him just to move him, but you want to try to do something with that expiring salary. No, it has not worked out. It's part of the reason why, as we've talked about, if you're looking at this team, you're saying, why do they not have depth? Why do they not have a bench? Well, Gabe Vincent, Lonnie Walker, Montrezl Harrell, right? Kendrick Nunn, these guys that they've invested in with their exceptions has not worked out. They've not found these long-term pieces that they need, in addition to a bunch of other moves that we could spend the next hour going over that have not worked out the way that they wanted them to. We could talk about the draft picks and draft capital and all of that. But what's interesting is that Gabe, over the three games prior to that, Gabe from three, 60%, 60%, 40%. You'll take all of those, and he's actually been on a little bit of a heater, but it takes one game where he's ice cold. He's not a bad guy. He's not a bad veteran to have on the team or anything like that, but it has not worked out. But I also want to remind everybody that it was not supposed to be Gabe The Lakers thought they were getting Bruce Brown. That was the role that they were filling. Was Bruce Brown coming in to be a whatever, a little bit of a do-everything defensive guy that could slot in there for them? That's what they were planning to get. And then suddenly Indiana came in and doubled the Lakers' offer. And not surprisingly, Bruce Brown took that. So the Lakers pivoted and said, who else is out there? Okay, let's go get Gabe Vincent. He wound up being the fallback to what was their plan A. It has not worked out at all. They haven't gotten bang for their buck out of him. They're not getting bang for their buck out of Jared Vanderbilt compared to where his salary is at. Same thing for Maxi Kleba. And again, it all goes into this bigger conversation about why this team is lacking in depth. It's also part of why, when we look at Gabe, as well as some of these other contracts around the NBA that are similar, why teams are so hesitant to take on any kind of long-term salary that's not an obvious and clear positive value. It's because of how damaging it is to have a player on your team that's not producing up to their contract level. So for all of the things that we've talked about here, yeah, Gabe is not necessarily a long-term fit, even an in-season fit this year with the Lakers. They do need to see what they can do with him. Maxey's contract as well as an expiring deal. Jason, you already mentioned Gabe's defense. That was the most disappointing thing for me because, you know what, like Gabe, he shot well recently. Everybody can have a bad night shooting. I'm okay with that. He's not going out there trying to miss shots or anything like that, but the one thing you're supposed to get out of Gabe is a guy who's going to be at the right spots at the right time, that's going to be at least a slightly above average defensive player, that's a guy that you can go out there, that you can put out on the floor from the coaching staff's perspective, you can put him out there and you can trust that he's going to play the role. And we haven't seen enough of that out of him. An 0-for-7 shooting night is frustrating, and that may cause fans to boo, but it's the other parts of the game that I think are even more concerning to me.
Yeah, you know, the Gabe experience has been really strange because I'm glad you mentioned the shooting. Gabe has, in a Lakers jersey, shot the ball very well when he's open. When he's shooting 52% this year on unguarded catch-and-shoot threes. Last season, he was at 45% on 107 attempts on unguarded catch-and-shoot threes. The problem is he never gets to the rim. Like, it doesn't drive a closeout, so there's no additional value from spacing in terms of slashing ability. He cannot make a contested three at all whatsoever. He was 31% on contested catch and shoots last year. This year, just 7-for-29, 24% on contested catch and shoots. And then he takes all of these bizarre, super high difficulty off the dribble threes too, and he can't make those. And so it's the two or three bad shots he takes every game, the inability to provide any sort of other offensive utility beyond wide open three-point shooting. And then again, if Con Knipple and Miles Bridges can just go right at you and get to the foul line or get to the rim, then you're not really providing any sort of value. And that to me, like, you know, and I know we're getting ready to shift in this direction anyway, so I'll just take it here. Yeah. But like, the thing that's glaring to me about this Lakers roster isn't necessarily the top half, it's the bottom half. Like, if you look at it and you go, yeah, there's some lack of balance with the starting lineup in the sense that you don't have a traditional starting three. But let's just pretend that you do in the sense that you're starting Marcus, okay? Let's pretend that Austin comes back and Marcus stays in the starting lineup and Rui comes off the bench. You talk Luka, LeBron, Austin, Ayton, Smart, Laravia, Jackson. That top seven, that's fine. Like, ideally, you upgrade one or two of those spots, but like, that I don't think is where the team is losing games, so to speak. Like, even like, I didn't even think Jake had a very good defensive game last night either, but he's been pretty good defensively at various points over the course of the season. It's when you get past that seven, the team sucks. Like, they're legitimately terrible once you get past that top seven. And that, I think, is where Rob Pelinka has really, really hurt this team. Is you go around the league, and when guys are in and out of the lineup for injuries, they always have like one or two draft picks from recent seasons or one or two flyers they took on a different lottery guy from a different team or a veteran signing or something. They have three or four dudes who can step up and play rotation minutes, and they can fill a role, and there's some semblance of continuity in terms of the way that they like to play as you get deeper into the roster. The Lakers have a bunch of non-NBA players in the back half of their roster. I'm watching a lot of lineups last night, and I'm like, these are not good basketball players that are on the floor alongside core rotation pieces for the Lakers. And like, you look around the rest of the league, and it's like, the Clippers have had this disaster season, but you get guys like Jordan Miller and Kobe Sanders who are stepping in and contributing for them. You look at Oklahoma City, or you look like any of these teams, they get to their 11th, 12th man. They get to their 9th, 10th man, and that's a good basketball player. Maybe not as good as the dudes in front of them, but they've got players. And I think where you've really seen the leak in talent on this roster is in that back half. And it wasn't a big issue to start the year. The Lakers were very healthy over the first couple months of the season, obviously, other than LeBron James. And now that we're in a stretch where we're seeing like legitimate rotation cuts for guys being hurt, it's just leaving this situation where all of a sudden you're like, man, there's not a lot of talent on this roster once you get past that seventh man.
Yeah, depth still absolutely a concern. And I know our next topic here is there pressure on Rob Pelinka to make a move? And we're going to get into that. But guys, I think we should just go into our question and answer, and that's going to naturally get us into whether or not there's pressure.
I'm sure.
Yeah, so let's do that. First, let's give a quick shout out to our sponsor, which is Underdog. We appreciate them. We'll be back in 30 seconds. Hey, California residents, Underdog is out here giving you more ways to play. You already know their player picks pick higher or lower on player stats. Now prediction markets are live for you. You can now pick spreads, totals, or game outcomes, combined with player picks for bigger payouts. New customers play $5 on fantasy, get $75 in fantasy bonus entries when you use our code COLLECTIVE. Team picks, player picks, all on Underdog. And don't forget, use that promo code COLLECTIVE, play $5 on fantasy, and get $75 in fantasy bonus entries. Big thank you to Underdog for sponsoring our show. All right, and again, a thank you to Underdog, great sponsor for our channel. If you guys haven't done so yet, please make sure you do subscribe to the channel as well. Turn on those notifications, and we need some more 5-star reviews over on Apple Podcasts. If you guys wouldn't mind going in there, toss us a review over on Apple Podcasts. All right, let's get to this. I love the Lakers, but can't watch this LA version anymore. Too slow, too predictable, too lifeless. Greetings from Austria. You know, for a fan base that was very excited to start the season, they started off with some wins, some exciting games. Luka was playing great. Austin was playing great. To where they're at now, I am getting a lot of this frustration out of the fan base with watching this team. You're not sure what you're going to get on a night-in, night-out basis, and you're seeing some similar issues popping up in terms of the athleticism really being a struggle, and we certainly saw that last night. Jovan, is there a solution this season that can re-energize Lakers fans, or is it the Hail Mary at the trade deadline? Is it getting the full everybody healthy, or is the team it just kind of is what it is and they're going to have to grind it out?
I don't know. I think it has to come with in the form of a trade or a couple of trades here. I just don't think this team is quite good enough. I came up with an intricate equation last night on my show that this explains the Lakers blowout losses. If you have a certain amount of athleticism, a certain amount of ball handling, and a certain amount of shooting, you are going to blow the Lakers out. And we've continually seen this of, especially like to quickly look back at last night. That starting group for Charlotte has four dudes who can cook you off the dribble, four dudes who can hit catch and shoot threes, even in the case of Knipl, obviously, like movement threes. And so it was just like pick your poison of where is the weak link in the Lakers defense? Who can we attack off the dribble? Can we get downhill, get them in rotation? And then inevitably, because that's the other thing with the Lakers is like they can be a good defense for like the first half of a possession. Mm-hmm. But once you get the Lakers into rotation and actually having to make multiple efforts, they inevitably are going to cave and break down at some point in the possession. So I think that's like a thing that I don't know if that's fixable with the current group. Like, I think the Lakers have three guys right now I trust defensively, Marcus, Jake, and Vando. But then those guys come with a host of offensive concerns and inconsistency that limits some of, like, then you just play off those guys and dare them to shoot. And some nights they'll hit a bunch of threes. Often they will miss a bunch of threes. And, like, I just think that they need to remake this rotation to a degree. And we know the guys they should probably keep. We know the guys that should be available for trade if they're willing to move on from them. But I think it's like, unless they somehow get healthy here in the next couple of weeks and are healthy for the entirety of the rest of the season, which is obviously unrealistic, even then, I don't think they're good enough defensively, but at least they could be such a juggernaut offensively that they could, I think, overcome a lot of their issues with that. But for them to actually, I think, ascend back into the like true contention top of the league, I think it has to probably be at least one trade, if not two.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. It's going to have to be multiple trades, I think, in order to get them where they need to be. They've got to address, because you can't just go into the playoffs and say, well, hopefully we don't run into an athletic team with ball handlers that can shoot, because that's what the top playoff teams are going to have. You're going to run into those kinds of teams. And you're absolutely right defensively. I can't tell you how many times, it's like multiple times every game where the Lakers, you think, man, okay, they're rotating. All right, they're really putting in the effort defensively. This is nice. 16 seconds, 18 seconds. It's the final rotation, and they give up an open three with, say, 3 seconds or less on the shot clock. They can't do it for the full 24 seconds, and that's often that final link that gets exploited by their defense. All right, let's go here. Kevin said, I like targeting Kuminga, Wiggins, and Gordon once viewed the same way. And Wiggins and Gordon were once viewed the same way as him. LA are limited in the assets they have to develop two-way wings. For a Lakers team that needs defense and shooting, does Kuminga check either one of those boxes? That's my big concern with Jonathan Kuminga. Jason, I've been of the opinion that if you're going to go get Jonathan Kuminga, it has to be in a deal that's just a no-brainer. You view him as an expiring contract type thing, and if it doesn't work, you just move on this summer, and that's that. You can't give up significant assets to get him, and banking on the idea that what hasn't worked in Golden State is suddenly going to work in LA. Where do you stand on Kuminga for the Lakers?
Yeah, I know I worded this very strongly to you guys in a text message last night, but I'm not a big Jonathan Kuminga fan. Wiggins was legitimately one of the best perimeter defenders in the league in Golden State. Like, that is not what Jonathan Kuminga is. We talked earlier about the difference between being there and being disruptive. Jonathan Kuminga is a big example of that, in the sense that one of the reasons why Moses Moody was a much better perimeter defender than Jonathan Kuminga over the last few years in like primary one-on-one type of matchups is Kuminga had a habit with being there but not being disruptive. I thought opening night was a classic example. He was always on Luka's hip, but Luka was just getting whatever he wanted because Kuminga wasn't being disruptive. And similarly, Gordon, I think, is a substantially better prospect start to, like, top to bottom. He's bigger, he's stronger. I actually think in terms of his like ability to play off of 2 feet, he's a more useful athlete, substantially more offensive polish than Jonathan Kuminga ever had, even at his age in Orlando. Like, to me, Jonathan Kuminga is just he's a guy that, like, some team out there that can afford to take a risk, meaning like they can afford to give Jonathan Kuminga the ball for 2 years and see if he develops. I think he's worth trying. Like, I think I'm not out here saying that he's not an NBA player, that he doesn't deserve to have a chance. He certainly does. I just think if you're a dead serious team that's looking to compete in the next couple of years, Kuminga's not for you.
Yeah. Yep. That's ultimately where I land on him too. Like, if it's Gabe Maxey, and whose salaries happen to line up to the dollar with Jonathan Kuminga, if it's that, and you're going to get Kuminga for the rest of the year, and hey, if it doesn't work, and you move on, sure, why not? You know, but then if Golden State's
why is Golden State doing that?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Golden State's not doing that. Let's go here. 4-4 during the last stretch, during the easy stretch of the season. 4-4 last 8 games during the easy stretch of the season. Yeah, you look, they're 1-2 during this start of this 5 games and 7 nights stretch here. Your opponents were the Kings, the Hawks, and the Hornets. And again, you're losing right now this stretch here. Not good. Probably will have to face a top 4 seed in the first round. Did LeBron hurt himself on the last layup? Jovan, I didn't see anything with LeBron injury-wise. Possible I missed it, though.
I think I missed it, too. I think he's going to be okay, though. I haven't heard anything in terms of him missing any time, but we'll obviously get the injury report later today. Mm-hmm. I think this is a really good point, and I think this is where some of my disappointment comes in, because I mean, we could extend this. They're 5-8 in their last 13, and looking at that stretch, they're I believe they're 19th in offense, 26th in defense, and 25th in net rating. So you have almost a month stretch here that the Lakers have been basically a bottom 5 team in the NBA, at least from a net rating perspective. And there's a correlation there with no Austin, or I think Austin's only played in 2 of the 13 games, and he wasn't fully healthy in those 2 games he appeared in. So they've really missed him, I think, particularly on the offensive end. But
He's a top defender on this team too, yo.
Maybe defensively too, based on some of the guys that are playing. But I think this is a bit of a missed opportunity here for LA. And I was talking about this last night, like just going 1-2 this week. And if we're being honest with how they're playing, they're probably going to split this weekend. I don't have great confidence in them going into Portland and coming back and beating Toronto. I think they're probably going 1-1 this weekend. There now is starting to be some distance between them and the top four. They're two games back of the four seed, three games back of the three seed. Doesn't sound like much, but those teams are all playing. Like Minnesota's playing great basketball right now. OKC has found a groove again. They've won five in a row. Denver continues to win without Jokic. And then San Antonio lost Wemby last night for a bit of that game, still ends up winning the game convincingly. So those teams are all continuing to win at a certain rate. And if the Lakers end up being in that like 5-7 range, even if they end up getting healthy, even if there are some things that they learn about them, like I totally agree with Jason that we've seen a lot of progress with LeBron in general, but also specifically LeBron and Luka and like elements of the offense. I think the horn sets and playing out of the post more, like that's been great. The issue is if this team's a 5 or 6 seed, I think they're going to be a notable underdog in the first round, like almost regardless of who they're like, if they're playing Minnesota, Denver, San Antonio, I think the version of this Lakers team that makes a deep run has to be a top four seed, has to have home court in the first round. I don't know that this is a team that's going to necessarily win a first round series on the road, to be completely honest. So that's my concern right now is there's still plenty of time, especially if they get healthy, if they make a move, they can ascend back in the top four. But with how things are currently trending, they're looking like they're probably going to be a 5 or 6 seed. And I it doesn't mean they can't win that series on the road, but they will enter that series as an underdog, in my opinion.
One of the things with Austin that I think is worth mentioning to your point, Jovan, like, because they're just bad right now. And they're bad on both ends. One of the things with Austin is he is one of their best catch and shoot players. He's one of their best drivers of the basketball. He's one of their best, like, overall passers, connective passers. He's their second best pick and roll player, second or third best shot creator overall. If you're ranking the guards defensively, like, I think he's a better defender than Gabe. Like there's a certain amount of like just putting him back in patches a lot of holes to where, like, at the very least, when Austin's healthy, this team should be at least a great offense, which at least gives them something foundationally to go on, where when he's out, I just don't think they're good enough at anything else to cover for it. So, like, I think the main thing here is with Austin missing this much time, you just have this month and a half in the middle of the season where the team's bad and you're going to lose a bunch of ground in the standings. But if this kind of goes back to two questions ago, but if you're looking for a point of optimism, it's that when Austin comes back, you should at least be a good offense. And that should at least be enough to give you a better chance to compete night to night, especially if a couple other things break right with the roster.
I think one of my concerns is the games they're dropping right now. They did a good job early in the season in beating the teams they're supposed to beat. And they've struggled now lately with that. And part of that is the teams they've been playing have turned the page and started playing some better basketball. We talk about the Kings, we talk about the Hornets, but also you dropped a game to the Bucks. They were doing a nice job making sure that they added stacked wins on their roster. People kept talking about, well, the Lakers, they only beat the bad teams. Well, now they're dropping some games to some teams, to some of the quote unquote bad teams that are playing better basketball than the oversimplification of just that's a bad team they're playing against. But nonetheless, they're dropping some of those games. That concerns me as we get deeper into the season, especially once we hit the month of March, when we get into April, the home stretch for them is going to be really tough. They're going to have to get these guys healthy. They're going to have to also figure out a true identity. To start this season, we saw this Lakers team that was this next level offense, particularly in the half court. They were executing so well there. They've had a little stretch here where they flipped into being a better defense. And then over the last, week and a half, 2 weeks, it's just kind of all been bad across the board. They've got to figure out what it is that they really are, what they are trying to be, and go from there. But I am concerned about this slide right now. And let's face it, if it continues much longer, they're going to be in the play-in. And that's the direction that they're trending right now. Let's go here. Think OKC picks up the options on Dort and Hartenstein. Any options like this available in the offseason or trades with teams looking to shed salaries? New York Cleveland. First of all, if I'm the Knicks or the Cavs, I'm not shedding salaries now. I'm giving myself a shot this year and then shedding those salaries over the summer, particularly the Cavs, the only second apron team in the NBA this year. If they're going to part ways with players, if they're going to trade away somebody, I know we've talked about DeAndre Hunter, maybe something could happen there, but if they're going to do anything decisive in terms of Darius Garland, Jared Allen, guys like that, that have been in the rumor mill for a while, my opinion, I'm not doing that. If I'm the Cavs, I'm waiting till the summertime. I want to give this team one more shot to really make a run here in an Eastern Conference playoffs that should be relatively open for them, even though they haven't played their best basketball over the course of this year. They played great during the regular season last year and then flamed out in the playoffs. I want to give them a chance, give them the opportunity to flip that this year. As far as OKC with Dort and Hartenstein, look, they go back to back. OKC may just say, screw the second apron. Fine. We don't care. We're the champs and we're going to win the, and we're going to keep going here and we'll bring back everybody. If they do decide they want to duck the second apron, they probably have a difficult decision to make with one of Dort or Hartenstein. Kenrich Williams is also on a team option where maybe that could offer them a little bit of flexibility. Let's also not forget that OKC has a ton of draft picks, potentially as many as four in the first round this year, depending on pick protections. They're a team to definitely keep an eye on to take picks now and kick them down the road for a later pick because they don't have the roster spots or the financial flexibility to add those players right now. So I wouldn't go into this offseason expecting Hartenstein or Dort to be available. It's possible if they really decide the most important thing is ducking the second apron. But when you're the Thunder and you've played the way that you have, and if you win another championship, I just can't imagine they'd say, hey, we're going to offload a key piece simply for second apron reasons. If you're ever going to say we'll pay the second apron and we'll deal with all the penalties that come with that, it's when you've got a roster that's as set as OKC's.
If you guys had to pick between Dort and Hartenstein, for if you're put yourself in OKC shoes, you're Sam Presti, who are you picking between those two?
I'm taking Dort. I was talking about this on my show the other day. I think if you're going to be the starting center alongside Luka, you either need to be an elite vertical spacer or an elite shooter. So I think some of these kind of like a little bit of everything type of bigs, like Isaiah Hartenstein, who can vertical space and does provide some spacing in the form of like that little floater that he hits and can switch a little bit and can drop a little bit. I think that kind of big, another example would be like Jakob Poeltl, like a guy like Jakob Poeltl, a very good center. I just don't think he'd be the right kind of guy to have alongside Luka.
Sorry, not for the Lakers. For if you're OKC and you have to decide between these two of which one you're keeping, which one you're
Hartenstein. I'm keeping Hartenstein if I'm OKC.
Agreed. Now I think Dort's more replaceable.
I would note, though, that there is $10 million plus in salary separating the two. So shedding Hartenstein could help you there, but ultimately, yes.
They could renegotiate a deal, though.
Yeah, and let's also remember the Thunder, they overpaid Hartenstein on purpose when they signed him in order to get that team option. They had the money to spend. They did that to get him away from New York, and they could wind up. He is extension eligible this summer, so it's possible they chop that number down this summer by giving him a new deal at a lesser average annual value and then kick that out a few more years. So something to watch there with them. As far as teams looking to shed salaries, that, you know, the Lakers, one of the things that they can offer on the market is future flexibility by way of their expiring contracts. So teams looking to shed salaries could wind up calling up the Lakers and saying, hey, you know, we're interested in adding your expiring contracts to a deal, but that's not where you're going to get the big transformative, hey, here's the fifth starter that we've talked so much about. That probably isn't coming via just getting involved as being a third team in a deal or something like that.
No.
All right, let's go here. Took my friend who doesn't watch ball to the game last night, and even she was wondering why Ayton wasn't getting rebounds and nobody was defending that three.
Your friend knows ball.
I've watched a couple games with my wife this season, and she played basketball in college too, but it's funny to watch her too. Like, she hasn't watched the Lakers much this year, but she'll sit down and she'll be like, why is this happening? Why is that happening? I'm like, I'm saying, I don't know what to tell you.
Jovan, do you think if the opportunity presented itself, the Lakers would trade Ayton at the deadline?
It's hard to say without knowing who is potentially sure. coming back in a trade. I will note that ESPN, I believe it was Brian Windhorst and Tim Bonteps, reported this morning in a trade article that they did that the Lakers are seeking perimeter help, which we knew already in terms of two-way play, but also rim protection. So I thought that that's like the first, I think Jake Fisher had it out there that they don't view DeAndre Ayton as a long-term fit. And then today from ESPN, they're reporting that the Lakers are looking for some rim protection on the market. So that would indicate that I don't think they're doing that to replace Jackson Hayes. I think that that would be more of a big move to replace DeAndre Ayton. So I think it depends on the context of what's out there. I don't think you just trade Ayton to trade Ayton and take a step back with, like, as we've discussed, that there's some nuance here of he has outperformed his contract and he has largely been solid and done exactly what the Lakers have needed from that position. I would say he's been a better, like comparing him to Jackson Hayes last year, I think it's clearly been an upgrade in terms of the overall production and his play. Now, has it been championship level? Do you have confidence of how he would stack up in a series against Denver or Houston or OKC or San Antonio or Minnesota, right? Like you go, like all the other top teams in the West have multiple centers, are much stronger in the interior than LA is. That's a concern. But one thing here that I think is really interesting is that, so you had the two times Jackson closed over him recently. Then we found out from JJ, I thought this slid under the radar. JJ admitted and indicated that Jackson got injured at the end of the Sacramento game. And had Jackson not gotten injured, he was going to close with Jackson over DA at the end of the Sacramento game. So that would have been the third time mm-hmm. in five games that Jackson was closing over DA. Then last night, he pulls DA at the 9-minute mark and doesn't bring him back in and just goes with this small ball look that wasn't working. I get it. In theory, he was switching everything that they switched to. We're going to red everything and we're going to go small. But he once again did not close with DA, even with Jackson out. There's been like the last, so I would say over the last eight games, there's been three times he has not closed with him. And one time he was planning on not closing with him, but then Jackson got hurt. That already is like a shift in like early in the season, DeAndre Ayton was bulletproof. It didn't matter if he was mm-hmm. having a good game or a bad game. He was playing 30 plus minutes. He was closing every game. That has shifted here in the last like 2 weeks. And I do wonder if that ultimately indicates they, doesn't mean they go in a different direction, but they're at least open to going in a different direction because JJ clearly has lost some trust and confidence in him over the past couple of weeks.
That yeah. possession where he got outrun by Musa Diabate and CN James just threw that easy kick
right after a basket. They just scored.
He's jogging at center court. He's jogging. He's capable of keeping up in the open floor. It was just really disappointing.
Getting to one of our big picture topics here. MJ said this roster is like oil and water, bleach and vinegar, disaster waiting to happen. Pelinka's job is on the line this trade deadline and upcoming off season. So our question was, is there pressure on Rob Pelinka? Do you guys think there is pressure? I mean, he had a contract extension. We do have new ownership in place though. Is Rob Pelinka under pressure to get something done at the trade deadline here? Can he wait until the offseason?
He should be, but I mean, Jovan, you spoke to this last week, like apparently the vote of confidence, you expect him to be in charge for the next 5 years, you had said, right?
That's what Dave McMenamin reported, mm-hmm. That he expects JJ and Rob to be in place as long as Genie is the primary governor. Like the plan right now is for Rob and JJ to remain in charge in their respective positions. I think there's a lot of pressure on him. I don't think his job is currently in jeopardy or he's on the hot seat. I think mm-hmm. it would probably have to be maybe looking at like the 2027 deadline / summer. And if things have not changed since that, or, you know, up to that point, that's where it's a different conversation. But I think there's a lot of things here in terms of the deadline, how they perform in the playoffs, what they do this offseason, how they handle Austin's negotiation, how they handle the LeBron situation, what they do in terms of potential signings or trades. Then you have the next trade cycle. Then you also have how they fare in the playoffs again, and then that offseason. So I think it's going to be a little bit longer of a runway here for him. Again, whether we could debate how much credit he should get for the Luka trade, but that is carrying a lot of weight here in addition to They won a championship under his watch. I'm not saying I agree with this line of thinking. I'm just telling you what I'm hearing behind the scenes in terms of their confidence in him and wanting to give him a certain amount of time to build this. So I know fans want the team to move in a different direction with the front office and with leadership, but my understanding, at least for right now, is I don't think that's changing for at least like a year and a half. And that's probably like on the absolute soonest side.
I think it's worth mentioning, like, when you're talking about a GM, because with respect to the conversation surrounding Luka, I would argue that the back half of the roster is actually a bigger mark of a GM's ability than the front half, because there's a certain amount of that player politics, agency politics, which franchise you're working for. Like, there's certain things that, you know, a certain star like a Jokic, who, for instance, gets drafted and, you know, no one expected him to become the star that he became, but he is fiercely loyal to his franchise and stays there for as long as he stays there. You know, there's certain things at the top of the roster that aren't as associated with what the GM does. But once you get past that core five or six players at the top, that back half of the roster really is a reflection of like your scouting staff, your pro personnel department, how you manage your smaller contracts that you spend each summer, like mid-level exceptions and biannual exceptions and veteran minimum deals and the types of talent that you value relative to the rest of the league. And I think that has just been an example, the glaring example of where Rob has dropped the ball over the last few years.
And I think you can make the argument as well, and I don't think it's even an argument, I think it's just fact, that in the NBA over the last number of years, that back half of the roster has become more important than perhaps ever before in this league. Depth is a more important factor now in the NBA than we've ever seen. And that's both due to the injuries that are coming up, but also attributed to stylistically the way the game is being played right now. The teams that are finding the ability or having the ability to find players for the back half of their roster, find players that can, when somebody gets hurt, find another player that's going to step in. Think about AJ Mitchell with the Oklahoma City Thunder and the season that he's had this year, his ability to step in. You look at a number of guys around the NBA who have done that. Having players that can do those things is a more important factor and more important part of a general manager's job than it would have been, say, 5 years ago, where all you're really looking for is the guy that can hit the home run and get you the big-time superstar, and that's all that really matters. I think thinking around the NBA in terms of how the roster needs to be built has to change, and the teams that have already made that change and changed their focus in terms of building out the depth the way they need to, they're ahead of the curve right now. I think the Lakers are still playing catch-up in that area.
Absolutely.
To be clear, quickly here, I want to be clear. I'm not defending the front office. I have plenty of gripes. We could do an hour show here on my gripes with what the front office has done the last 5 years. I think there have been plenty of mistakes that could give you pause or question in terms of whether you should move forward with them. I'm just stating how what I'm hearing about what the team is saying, how the team is viewing it. So you can disagree with that. I'm not defending that by any means. I think if it were up to me, I'll just say there would be a lot of pressure right now, and there would be, how do you nail this deadline and what do you do this offseason? And if you can't execute at the highest level, then there needs to be a bigger conversation of what the team does moving forward. But I'm just stating what I'm hearing in terms of how they're viewing it right now.
There, you see, the crowd wants angry Jovan.
Don't get me going.
Jovan, let's talk about the starting five.
Yeah, seriously.
I'm kidding.
It's been better. It's been better.
All right, we're going to do, we'll do one more. Well, here, I can fly through this one real quick. LA should tank and try to trade Austin Reeves and get some assets. Well, they're not going to tank. And we've already gone over a bunch about it. They've won too many games already to tank, but and nor is that in their DNA right now. That's not what they're going to do. But for getting some assets, trading Austin Reeves, he's not under contract next year. Nobody's going to give up significant assets for a guy who can bail in July. But let's go here. This roster has too many holes. Best case scenario, it takes two trade seasons and a summer to correct, and that's with moves that hit. Realistically, this could be a 2 to 3 year process. I think the team is hoping, based on, you look at the flexibility they've got, the team is hoping that this will be this summer you can pivot the team fully, and whether that includes LeBron or not, I think everything right now is still up in the air. They can make the significant changes and pivot the direction of the franchise with the flexibility that they've got this summer, and then to go from there, and then it's minor tweaks from that. And that's, but part of what he's saying is correct, and part of that is why I'm in favor of trying to make some type of a move in a positive direction towards the kind of roster that they ultimately need to get if that opportunity is available at the trade deadline, rather than just banking on fixing everything over the summer. If it is a 2 to 3 year process, well, then you're talking about a 29-year-old Luka, and then you get into much bigger questions when you start doing that. But I don't think it's necessarily going to take 2 to 3 years. The problem is you can't miss. You have to bat 1,000 in order to get this team where they need to be, with the ability that you're going to have to make moves.
I agree with the point you're making about Luka, in the sense that, like, he's kind of limping around every game now as a 26-year-old. So I'm not sure I love the idea of 29-year-old Luka being, you know, some sort of apex athlete, so to speak. I do think that there's some truth to the fact that the Lakers are multiple trade cycles away from being a top-tier contender. On that, I fully agree. Like, to be in the class of Denver and Oklahoma City and whoever else you view in that tier, on that we agree. I do think that the Lakers are capable of getting kind of back to that second-tier contender status this season if they hit on a couple of deals at the deadline. And my reason for that is pretty simple. One, I do genuinely believe the loss of Austin is making this team look a lot worse than you'd think, because he's just quite simply, he's probably more valuable to the team than LeBron because of the fact that the Lakers have another four that they can slot into that position. They have nothing that replicates what Austin does in terms of dribble, shoot, pass proficiency at the guard position and the ability to play both ends of the floor. Like, to me, the loss of Austin is super valuable. You get him back. Also, just in general, I'm a big believer that, like, a lot of times if you have a gaping hole and you address it, it can actually manifest in a greater benefit to the team than it appears on paper, because of that specific spot being so valuable and it getting filled and having trickle-down effects that can kind of influence other parts of the team. And so, again, like, do I think they're going to be a top-tier contender within the next few trade cycles? No, it's going to take a lot of hits between now and then. But do I think they could become in the same class that we see San Antonio in this season as, like, a puncher's chance threat who could upset a team or two? And if they made it to the Western Conference Finals, you wouldn't be completely stunned. I still think that's on the table this season. I just think they'd have to hit at this particular deadline.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, I don't think you can waste 2 to 3 years of Luka's prime. Yeah. Luka's in his prime now, and I know it's difficult to build the right roster in a limited amount of time, but that's the job. Like, that's what you got to figure out. That's why you're in that position to be in charge of this franchise and in the prime of Luka's career. Like, that's on you to figure it out ASAP.
Yep. That's going to be the pressure. And I'll tell you what, Luka's going to have the ability to have some direction in a short order. Before you would think, he's going to have the ability to potentially, if he decides, hey, this is not working out, to change things. So there is...
If that's the one variable now, here that I think could accelerate when we talk about the coaching situation or the GM situation. If Luka wants to exert his power, as we've seen stars do in the past, that's the one thing that could accelerate this.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. All right. I'm going to save our super chats. We'll get into the rest of them on our next show, but do appreciate all of you for joining here today. Obviously a frustrating loss last night for the Lakers. We'll see what they can put together this weekend. Another back-to-back. You got Toronto, and that's not going to be easy. Second night of back-to-back on Sunday. We'll see who plays in that one. So everybody, thank you again. Please make sure you do subscribe right here to the channel. Turn on those notifications as well. Till next time, we'll see you and stay safe.